right? We got a lot of different things coming at you today, okay? And I'm just sensing a little bit of a lull right now. You don't got time for that, all right? Let's go. Break it. Let it cross. Woo!
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
You're listening to Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Hey, what's happening? Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I'm Derek Johnson, filling in on the day once again for Nick Schwert, who's out with his tonsil issue. KU has their first member of the class of 2020. How about that? Tyon Grant Foster. And if that name doesn't sound familiar to you, didn't really sound familiar to me until today. He is a junior college transfer, or will be, I guess, after next season, and he'll join KU for next season, as you could imagine. We'll talk with David Leske of Baseball Prospectus coming up in about half an hour here. We'll also let you hear the press conference from Les Miles. We'll let you hear some player audio from KU football and from KU basketball. And we'll talk about the Chiefs and whatever they're doing, chiefing it up right now. But Tyon Grant Foster, the newest member of the KU basketball team, at least he will be next season, barring a decommitment, which I guess, yeah, you never know. That happens all the time. But Grant Foster listed at 6'7", 185 pounds. He is a wing. At least that's what he is listed as. He's actually, if you click his profile on 24/7 Sports, says he's the shooting guard. So pretty much he can play anywhere between shooting guard, small forward, and I would imagine at 6'7", certain times could maybe even call for him to play as a small ball four. So pretty much you got a versatile wing who can play anywhere between the two and the four, and that's appealing. Now, he's only 185 pounds. How much would you want to use him as a small ball four? That kind of remains to be seen. Maybe you get him to add weight if that's kind of the intention of what you're going for here, but maybe that's not. Maybe you just think he can be a successful two-man, three-man, whatever. He hasn't shot it great in his junior college career, so maybe it would make more sense to be a small ball four. But we'll get to that in a second. So this is a kid who's kind of from the area. At least he's from Kansas City. He went to Schlegel High School, which is in Kansas City. It's a smaller school out in Kansas City. And on top of that, he's actually at his current junior college, which is Indian Hills Community College. He is a preseason first-team All-American, according to Street and Smith's basketball magazine, which, from what I can guess, is basically like a junior college preseason preview magazine. And the team he's on in that same magazine, they're in the preseason top 10. So he's on a pretty good team at Indian Hills Community College, and he's a pretty good player on that team, according to everything there. So for Grant Foster, that means that by the time he comes to Kansas, he would obviously be a junior with 2 years left to play. Who knows, maybe even if you redshirt him, then that gives you 2 years of play, but 3 years at the school. The last JUCO player I remember Bill Self and KU bringing on was Mario Little, and he was like the top junior college prospect in the entire country. I remember a couple years ago, they were going after that Shakur Justin kid, who I think ended up picking UNLV. I think he actually ended up in the transfer portal this year after having a pretty good year at UNLV. But this is, I guess, the first, if it is, since Mario Little. Kind of shows this doesn't happen very often. Not that it's that big of a surprise. And I guess the immediate question would go to, well, why now? Because given the timing of this happening after the NCAA issues their allegations on KU, it does kind of make you jump to the conclusion of, wait a minute, is this part of the NCAA sanctioned stuff that's kind of hurting us in recruiting to where we're not going to be able to land these five stars and these high-end four stars anymore. I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but maybe it does, having that stuff happen, make you kind of want to get a backup option, or get backup option might not be the right way of putting it, but getting somebody in the fold who you feel confident in that, hey, if we lose a lot of players this year and if we don't have as good of a recruiting class as we want somebody who's going to be able to come in and play a reasonable amount of minutes, be in the rotation right off the bat when he comes in. And maybe that's what you get here with this move. But again, this sounds like a pretty good kid from the JUCO. So it's not just scouring the JUCO ranks just because you have no other option and you have to bring somebody on. I mean, he had offers from Arkansas, Georgia, Iowa State, Kansas State, LSU, Oklahoma State, SMU, Texas, among others. And the two biggest schools, it seems like, that were in on this kid were LSU. That's a team who made the Sweet 16 last year. And Iowa State. And Iowa State, that's where he actually recently visited. Iowa State's a team who's had some success with JUCO guys over, I don't know, really since Fred Hoiberg. It seems like they have a JUCO guy or two every now and then that finds some success. So if Iowa State's in on him, I'm all for it with KU. But he played in 32 games last season, averaged a little over 8 points per game, averaged a little over 4 rebounds per game. So the number's not really going to jump off the page. Wasn't that good of a shooter. He was at like 37% from the field, 27 from three, 68 from the free throw line. All those numbers did go up in conference play. He averaged like 10.5 and 5 in conference play. So that would lead you to believe he's on the right trajectory, and part of the reason I'm sure why he's a preseason first team JUCO All-American, according to that magazine. This isn't going to be a star player, though. That's not what Mario Little was. And if you're having the expectation that this is all KU is going to be able to do in recruiting, I would slow the brakes on that. I do think it might show a little bit of what the NCAA stuff is doing, and the fact of, hey, instead of us having a 4- or 5-man class where our fifth and fourth guy are top 120 recruits in the country, like, yeah, we might have to dip into the JUCO to get that fourth or fifth guy every now and then. Or maybe it's like I said earlier, you just want kind of that security blanket to know that if you strike out in recruiting and you lose a lot of these players on your current team, you have somebody who can come in right away and fill some of those minutes. And that could be very much the case, because you're probably losing Devon Dotson. You're for sure losing Udoka Azubuike. We'll have to wait and see with Mitch Lightfoot whether you lose him or not based on if he took a red shirt or not. And then after that, it's like, well, either Silvio DeSosa or David McCormick, they could have a big year and go pro. Would a freshman like Jalen Wilson, could he have a pretty big season right away? And could he go pro after a year? Could Ochai Agbaji emerge? And he's obviously got the pro athleticism and body. So if he emerges and puts up good numbers, could he go pro after this year? You could lose a lot of players if you're Kansas after this season. And that doesn't even take into account, usually, schools like Kansas and really everyone around the country at this point, you're going to lose a player pretty much every year due to transfer. That's just kind of how things have gone lately in college basketball. So to bring on a guy that you feel confident in is going to be able to contribute to the rotation in day one when you're losing a lot of those players, it gives you some confidence for next season. And it's kind of like having that security blanket that you know, well, at the very least, we have this guy. And like Mario Little, as I referenced, Mario Little wasn't a guy who was asked to be top 2-3 scorer on the team. And like now you look at Mario Little, and that kind of is the mantra of what he does. Like, he is a one-on-one scorer. He is a guy who will put up 15 points per game for whatever EuroLeague team he's playing for that season. Like, Mario Little is a good pro scorer. But when Mario Little was in college at Kansas after coming in as one of the best JUCO recruits in the country, he came in, and part of it, I'm sure, was he suffered through a lot of injuries in his time at KU. He was going through some nagging injuries, so I'm sure that held him back from doing everything he kind of wanted to do. But part of it, too, those KU rosters that he was on were absolutely stacked. And so he came on with the intention of being a role player. He came on with an opportunity to kind of impact the game as a glue guy, so to speak. He would get rebounds, play defense for you. But he was never a guy that they called upon to carry the load offensively for them or be like the guy on either end of the court for KU. And that's kind of how I view this. With Grant Foster, he's not going to come in here and you're going to be expecting him to be your best player of the recruiting class. You're probably bringing him on because you want that security blanket, you want a guy who can contribute to the rotation, and you don't know who's all going to be back next year, so you're trying to kind of weather that storm. And so all those things make sense. And if you want to get into the conversation of how much the NCAA stuff is affecting their recruiting, maybe this is kind of a first sign in regards to that. And maybe we'll get another on Thursday. If Isaiah Todd, the top 15 recruit, commits to Michigan or chooses to go overseas, because I know that's a rumor, pretty much he doesn't pick Kansas. Maybe that narrative kind of gets pushed on a little bit more in conjunction with this. But I kind of think this might be a little bit more of a coincidence than anything. Now, the fact that you get a JUCO kid this early on in the game, maybe that suggests otherwise, because for the most part, you would think, oh, if we're going after a JUCO guy, it's because we struck out in the spring, didn't get this 4 or 5-star kid we wanted, so let's just give it to this JUCO guy. Maybe KU thinks really highly of this kid. If he had a solid season last year as a freshman, but now he's expected to take a big step, maybe they're trying to get in on him before he takes that big step, and then other schools come a call in, and you want to be kind of the first one in of the big schools in on this kid. That could be a reason, too. But I think it really is a little bit of everything. It's, well, the NCAA stuff is affecting it a little, but this also isn't the end of the world. KU's not just going to recruit JUCO guys. This is probably going to be the only JUCO guy they bring on for next year. That would be my guess, because the track record has said that's pretty much been the case. Mario Little, if he was the last guy that's won this decade. So, yes, the NCAA stuff, maybe it's affecting things, but I think this is more of a, well, okay, now we have our backup option in place. Now we have a guy who can come on, be a role player for us next year. And yes, ideally, if we didn't have the NCAA stuff, maybe we'd use the scholarship to try to get another 5-star. And so that's kind of lowering our confidence in that we're going to get a recruiting class of 5 players with 2 5-stars and 3 4-stars. So we'll get 1 JUCO kid instead of that. But I don't think this necessarily registers as, oh, well, they're just completely doomed in recruiting. Like, yes, it's going to be hard. You're going to face an uphill battle with the NCAA stuff. But I think this might just be kind of coincidence. This kid seems like he could be a pretty good player for KU, just not a star player, which that's fine. You can't have every player be a star player. If you had 12 5-star recruits on your team every year, like 3 or 4 of them are going to transfer after the year because they're not getting enough playing time and they're not going to fit the certain role that you want. And also, it probably bears mentioning that if KU moving forward wants to play more of a small ball 4 and have that be what they do consistently, this kid kind of seems like he fits into what you want there. I mean, I haven't seen him, and we'll talk with Scott Chasen of 24/7 Sports about it on Thursday, but he's 6'7", and he averaged 2 blocks per game last year as a freshman in conference play. So he's pretty good defensively, and if he's not like a great shooter, which he hasn't been, slide him down to the 4, all of a sudden, average, below average shooter from a 3 or 2 position becomes an average or a plus above average shooter as a 4-man. Pretty good on defense, get a little weight to him. I mean, Josh Jackson was 6'7", 6'8", and what, like 205 pounds? So it wouldn't be that unthinkable for this guy to gain 15, 20 pounds, and then you have the same height and weight distinction. Now, it obviously wouldn't be that good, but maybe that's part of it too, just trying to fit him in to what you want to do, and maybe he's somebody that makes a lot of sense there. Either way, I think the move's fine. I don't think this is doomsday or anything like that, that, oh no, you got a JUCO kid. They start getting like 3 or 4, like maybe then we'll talk. But right now, I think it could just be coincidence, and it's a move that could help them with the rotation, losing players, and a potential role player looking down the road. New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. We'll talk to David Leske in about 15, 20 minutes here. But coming up next, what is going on with the Chiefs? It's about 3:25 here on the New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. I'm Derek Johnson. Coming up in about 10, 15 minutes, we'll be joined by David Leske of Baseball Prospectus to give us an update on the Royals offseason, managerial search, and talk a little MLB playoffs. We'll let you hear the Les Miles press conference at the top of the 4 o'clock hour. I'll give you my college football playoff rankings at about 4:45 and plenty more conversation. But how about those Chiefs losing back-to-back weeks after we thought they were just about unstoppable? And now the question is, are they even that good? Well, this defense is definitely not. They're terrible. Let me read you a couple stats about this Chiefs defense. Texans did not punt once, and the Chiefs have only forced 6 punts in a 3-week span. The Texans had 6 drives of 10 plays or more. That's the first time they've done that in franchise history. Deshaun Watson, who was sacked 18 times coming into the game, not sacked once by the Chiefs. Houston faced no third downs on their game-winning drive. Chiefs couldn't even hold them past second down. And get this one. After the loss, Patrick Mahomes, who is the best QB in the NFL right now, although I think we saw a lot that Deshaun Watson isn't as far behind from Mahomes from that draft class as we think. But after the loss, Patrick Mahomes, the best QB in the NFL, is just 1-5 in games where the Chiefs trail at halftime. And before you mistake that 1-5 record for Mahomes not being clutch or something like that, that's not the case. The Chiefs' offense in those 6 games where they trailed at halftime with Mahomes, he averaged 18 points in the second half. That puts you on pace for a 36-point output for the game, which would basically lead the NFL every year. So he's been really good in the second half. The reason they're only 1-5, despite averaging 18 points in the second half when trailing at half under Mahomes, it's the defense that can't hold the opposition and make the necessary plays for the Chiefs to complete that comeback. And it's clearly not a coaching thing at this point. Like, I think that Steve Spagnuolo is still an upgrade over Bob Sutton because at least Steve Spagnuolo adjusts and tries things and blitzes. But I think we're pretty clearly seeing that this is not about coaching at this point. This is on Brett Veach, and this is on the players. Offensively, yeah, it's not pretty right now either. And it's not to the level we're used to. And that's kind of the problem here, that given the state of the Chiefs' defense, you're asking the Chiefs' offense to be Superman. And so offensively, when it's not pretty right now, and the offensive line has been so bad with the injuries, that combined with the Patrick Mahomes ankle injury and some head-scratching Andy Reid decisions yesterday, like the run on the second and long in the fourth quarter for the back-to-back weeks, your offense becomes not nearly as efficient. And the offense needs to improve as well. But I think a big part of that is probably more health-related, whereas the defensive improvements, it's not as much health-related, it's just you kind of stink and you need to get better. And the offense can get better with health and probably Andy Reid adjusting some things. Tyreek Hill, that was a nice first step to get your health back. He was a big boon for the offense yesterday, had the big touchdown catch early, had the second touchdown catch later. And because of Tyreek Hill returning, the offense did look a little closer to normal. And the awful call that overturned that pass interference that was on Travis Kelce that led to that interception in the end zone when Mahomes thought he had a free play, that seemingly turned the game on its head. And after that, your offense really wasn't the same. So that didn't help. But it also is worth mentioning, bringing Hill back didn't magically fix everything. Now, maybe him playing more snaps will help because he was pretty much on a timeshare with Mecole Hardman. They didn't want to overdo it in his first game back. But keep in mind, the Chiefs had the ball for just 2 minutes in the fourth quarter. 2 minutes, that's it. Partially, that's their fault because they didn't do anything when they had the ball. But that's the issue. They've been given zero margin for error to establish a rhythm. And that's where we are. If this offense for the Chiefs isn't the best in the league, they have no chance to be a real Super Bowl threat. None, if they're not the very best offense in the league. That's an unfortunate truth. And if they don't play like the best offense in the NFL, you start to have questions if this is even a playoff team. Like, if this is only the fourth best offense in the NFL, which I'm not saying it is, but over the past couple weeks, they've struggled. If that ends up being the case, and the defense is this bad, there's no guarantee you're even like a team who can make it past the divisional round in the playoffs or even into the playoffs. I mean, back in 2017, they started 5-0, and they plummeted to 6-6. Now, that team rebounded. They won 4 in a row, went to 10-6, and then they had that colossal failure with the Titans in the wildcard round. Obviously, can't afford to have that big of a drop before they figure things out. You hope this week is kind of bottoming out for the Chiefs. And I look around the NFL, and you see good teams losing head scratchers all the time. I brought up last week, the Patriots lost to like the Titans big last year. They lost to the Dolphins last year. Right now, the Rams and the Cowboys, they both started 3-0. They both lost their last three. The Cowboys just lost to the Jets. Good teams go through bad stretches all the time. And in the NFL, you lose head scratchers all the time. But now it's back-to-back losses. And now it starts to become more of an issue for the Chiefs because it's starting to become more of a trend. And now this week, you play on short rest. You play on a Thursday. Well, how much of your issues are you really going to be able to scheme out? Oh, and you also play a Denver team who has a pretty good defense, who plays a lot of man defense, and that's kind of what you struggled with the last couple weeks. Oh, and Denver's one strength offensively is they've got two really good running backs, and you can't stop the run. Oh, and then after that, you play the Packers. So the reason you start to get, I wouldn't say quite panicked, because I wouldn't hit the panic button just yet, but you can foresee hitting the panic button if you have the same struggles this week and you lose to Denver. And that's where we are. Their last 2 weeks, it's not going to be the end of the world if they turn it around. It's not like we're going to look back to this in 10 weeks if they turn this around and say, yeah, but I don't know if they can compete with the Pats. Did you see that week 5 game against the Colts? No. But if you lose this week to the Broncos, then it becomes, okay, this is a trend that they're just not figuring out. I think the bigger issue probably is that you're trying, obviously, to make the Super Bowl and you feel like you have a legit chance to do so. At least you did in the preseason and you did through 4 weeks. And so for that to be the expectation, you're naturally comparing yourself to the New England Patriots. And that's a loser's game because if you try to do that, it's just not going to work. And so maybe if the Chiefs are in the NFC where there's like always a lot of good teams and it's like, well, this team could make it, this team could make it. Like 1 year the Saints make it, the other the Rams make it, the other the Eagles make it, the other the Falcons. It seems like it rotates, whereas the AFC, it's like, nope, there's always the Patriots. Or when Peyton Manning was there, it's always the Patriots and the Colts or Broncos. It just always is. And so maybe if the Chiefs were in the NFC or there wasn't that looming issue of the Patriots hanging over your conference, we'd be talking about their issues, but more in a sense of, well, they're still in the conversation. Just get it figured out. But it feels like it's just this night and day battle between them and the Patriots are just this pristine, perfect wonder child that you're trying to compare yourself to, and it's just not going to happen. And that's why these issues are so large, though. Like, the goal here, the bar is set really high because that's what you think of this team, or at least you did, that you would hope this team can contend for a Super Bowl as close as they got last year. And so that is the goal, to get to the Super Bowl. And if that's the case, you're going to set the bar high. So stumbles like this back-to-back weeks, it's going to get magnified. And it probably deserves to be given if you're setting the bar that high. I mean, you have the biggest roadblock in NFL history sitting in your way if you want to make a Super Bowl. That's the New England Patriots. And they obviously have other roadblocks along the way too that maybe we didn't think were roadblocks. We thought they were just little bumps in the path. But I think now, after you've been manhandled by the AFC South, you say, okay, instead of it being the Patriots and Chiefs in the AFC and everybody else, it's now more likely it's probably the Patriots. And then the Chiefs and Texans and Colts and the Ravens, like all those teams are kind of close together. I mean, this tweet from Rainey Gisarelli, who he writes for The Athletic and The Ringer, it pretty much just sums it up. Here's what he tweeted. I don't want to overreact to a 4-2 team, but aside from having the best QB on earth, what exactly do the Chiefs do well? Run the ball? Nope. Protect the quarterback? Negative. Stop the run? LOL. Pressure the opposing QB? Meh. Special teams? Play disciplined. Penalty-free football. Ha. And yeah, Rainey Gisarelli, he's got a great point. What does this team do well besides having the best quarterback on earth? They have some good weapons. They have a coach who is good at game planning but has kind of struggled adjusting in game. I don't know. So unless things change, this is going to end up the same way with the Chiefs that we've grown accustomed to. Disappointment. And that's where we are right now. It's not time to hit the panic button just yet. But you lose on Thursday? Probably time to smash that thing. New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. I'm Derek Johnson. Coming up in about 5 minutes, we'll be joined by David Leske of Baseball Prospectus.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Welcome back, Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I'm Derek Johnson, filling in on the day for Nick Schwert. No replacement needed, though, for David Leske of Baseball Prospectus. He joins us now on RCST. So the Royals still without a manager. Any chance that they go into 2020 without a manager?
I mean, it might be better than who they pick if they did. But I think it's a pretty small chance they go without, unless they decide to just make Witt the player manager, which might not be the worst thing, considering one of the candidates is Mike Matheny. So I guess we'll see. You never know.
You know, we've floated around the idea on RCST of, like, best sports to make sense of having, like, a robot manager. And I feel like baseball's the given, right? Like, if you were to have a robot manager or robot coach in any sport, like, wouldn't baseball make the most sense?
Either baseball or I feel like it could work in football. I know you've got to read coverages and stuff like that, but I mean, if you've got a robot, can't you program it to read where the defenders are and where and how the team is lining up and all that? I mean, I feel like that would be built into the programming. So maybe football, but yeah, I mean, baseball, you can win with a formula in baseball, which means a robot is doable at the very least.
So what is the actual update on the managerial search right now?
Well, I mean, there's not a real update from the Royals perspective, which is not surprising because, like we've talked about, you know, they don't have an owner right now.
It sounds like Gabe Kapler is kind of the hot name right now on the market, the former Phillies manager who got let go by Philadelphia. Is that a name that makes sense at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kapler's got some ideas that may rub people the wrong way, but he was a hot name when the Phillies hired him for a reason. You know, this is not a guy who is without his merits, and he was in a really rough situation in Philadelphia. And that's a win-now team that wasn't really built to win now, and it's not his fault. So, I don't know, it'd be a different look, but I think he can do good things with the right team. And I don't know if the Royals are that team or not, but I think he could be wherever he goes next, I think he could be a very good hire.
What do you think is the timetable for the Royals? Obviously, like you said, it's kind of tough when you don't really technically have an owner to actually hire the manager. But, I mean, how long are we looking here?
I would say anywhere between 2 and 4 weeks. I think that I knowing the Royals, they're very private. I would imagine they've already talked to their internal guys, Griffol, Swaim, Matheny, Vance Wilson, who we haven't mentioned too much, but he's a name out there. You know, maybe if they want to interview any of the minor league guys, I imagine they've already talked. Externally, I don't know if there's a lot of guys from other organizations that they're looking into. But if so, I would guess they get to those pretty soon. And Yeah, then if a decision needs to be made, and a guy like Pedro Grifol is interesting because he wants to be in Kansas City. If he comes to the Royals and says, hey, I'm being offered the Giants job or whatever job because there's 8 available, I think the Royals might move to keep him if they need to. So I would say, you know, by somewhere between about Halloween and November 15th, I think we'll have a decision. And it might be before John Sherman's officially the owner, but it's not going to be too much longer at the very least.
Yeah, Grifol is the one that's interesting to me because I did see he was interviewing with the Giants. And, I mean, first of all, what does being a quality control coach mean? And second off, would Grifol actually be a good consideration for the manager position with the Royals?
Well, I mean, what it means is he controls the quality. He really he ciphers the information. He's kind of the go-between in a lot of ways. Interesting because the Royals, so J.J. Piccolo, their assistant general manager, is kind of being deployed in the minor leagues in a way that Grifol is deployed in the big leagues. Piccolo is going to be the guy who is kind of the intermediary with the numbers and the stats and all that, and explaining those to the guys and why they should care and all that good stuff. And Grifol kind of does that in Kansas City. And that's a big reason why I think he'd be a good manager, too, because he really understands the analytics, the stats, the numerical reasoning behind decisions, but he also has a really good baseball mind. And so he's also a guy who is capable of making the baseball decision in tandem with the numbers. And I think that's a really good skill to have, especially in today's baseball. And plus, he's a really good communicator. And it doesn't hurt that he speaks Spanish and English. So he's able to communicate with everybody pretty much, except for the occasional player who doesn't speak either, which is pretty rare in baseball, honestly. So I don't know. I just think he's a really good fit, and I think he'll do well wherever he lands.
We're talking with David Leske of Baseball Prospectus here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk. MLB trade rumors came out with their projections for the arbitration numbers for the Royals. Anything of note for you in what you kind of expect with arbitration this year?
No, nothing crazy. I think that, you know, I expect maybe two guys to go through arbitration. Mike Montgomery, and I kind of had him pegged for $3.5 million, somewhere in there, my own internal numbers. And Jesse Hahn, who, when he came back, he looked, the stuff was really good. Command was brutal, which it's not too surprising, I don't think. So I think they'll probably tender him a contract, and he'll be at about $1 million. And the other guy MLB trade rumors did not mention was Jorge Soler, who can opt out of his contract and into arbitration. I'm guessing he gets around $8 or $9 million. So nothing crazy out of line. You know, they're probably going to DFA guys like Chester Cuthbert and a couple others who I, off the top of my head, can't remember were in there. But I would guess they only end up keeping two or three of those arbitration guys and they'll make it some 40-man roster room with the rest.
As far as next year's roster goes, who is Daniel? I don't know if this is Tillo. Who is this guy?
So Tillo is an interesting name because he was their third round pick, 2016, I think, and Mr. Iowa in basketball, really good athlete, starting pitcher, gets a lot of ground balls, not a ton of swings and misses. He moved to Double-A, but he just wasn't getting it. Shifted him to the bullpen. The velocity bumped. His slider got better. And basically, he's turned himself into a real candidate for the 2020 bullpen for a couple reasons. One, he's getting guys out, and he's got to be out of the 40-man by the end of next season anyway. But two, the new rule where relievers have to face three or more batters is kind of doing away with the lefty specialist. And so Tillo is a guy who gets righties and lefties out, and you need that in your bullpen at your left-handed pitcher. So, you know, I look at him as a guy kind of like Brian Flynn, in that he can get you a ground ball pretty much whenever you want it, but the difference is he actually gets swings and misses too. So, you know, given what he did at the end of the season in Double-A, he's been short. The numbers aren't great, but he's looked really good in the Arizona Fall League. Now he's going to play on Team USA for the Olympic qualifying team. He's going to get a shot, and I think he has a real chance to make the team out of spring training.
Is the Royals opening day starter for 2020, is he somebody who's currently on the roster, or do you think he's somebody that they're going to go make a move for this offseason?
I would say 50-50. because I think if they go get somebody, they get somebody who's better than Brad Keller. And if they don't go get somebody, it's going to be Brad Keller. So I think that's pretty much where I land right now. And I know that totally rides the fence of your question. And I have no problem telling you that I'm a coward and not answering it. Because, you know, it's so hard to say right now. But I just have this strange feeling, and I don't know who it is yet, but I think Dayton Moore thinks the Royals are pretty close. And, you know, I don't agree with it, but he's the one who makes the decisions. And I think because of that, I think they might make a move for a guy who's 2 or 3 years, kind of a Shields deal. You know, we talked about that before. 2 or 3 years from free agency, going to be here when, you know, Coar and Singer and Lynch and Bubich and Bolin and Hawks and Hake and all those guys start to come to the big leagues over the next 2 or 3 seasons. I could see it. I could see it happening. And I don't know that it's the right move, but, you know, look, it'll make the team better, whatever that move is, in all likelihood. So there's that. I'm not sure. I think it's a year too early, honestly, and so maybe it doesn't happen. But I could absolutely see it happening. And you know, what I laid out is probably going to be Dayton Moore's exact rationale if it does happen. We needed somebody to help the young pitchers. And that's what he'll say. And that guy would probably start on opening day. So if they don't make that move, it's Keller. If they do, it's that guy. So I have completely avoided your question successfully. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, it was a knowledgeable way of putting me to rest. So you have a politician future in your career if you want.
Excellent.
It. But is there somebody that, I mean, forget what you think's going to happen from your end, if you were the GM, is there somebody in free agency who you think is available via trade that you really want the Royals to acquire because you think it would be a good fit?
I mean, there's some guys, you know, personally, I wouldn't spend a whole lot in 2020 just because they're going to be better in all likelihood because you almost have to be. No, I said that last year, and they were one game better. But
still better.
They're still better. You're right. They were still better. I think that you want to, if you really want to continue the trend of finding veterans to sign in free agency who you can flip in July, you've got to go get better ones. And one name I keep coming back to, and it kind of depends on Alex Gordon's decision, but one name I keep coming back to is Corey Dickerson. He can play left field. He's a left-handed hitter. He can hit. He had a little trouble staying healthy, but that's a guy who, if he's healthy in July, some team is going to pick him up, even if it's just a bat off the bench. And I think that's a move that I believe could be really beneficial short and long term for the Royals. You know, I wouldn't want to see him on a 3-year deal. I'm talking 1 year, $5 million, something like that. That's a much better value than Billy Hamilton, than Chris Owings, than any of these schlubs who they bring in, and they end up having to release. And so he's a guy who I keep coming back to. You know, personally, I would like to see them go get somebody who can handle center field just in case they get to July and Bubba Starling is hurt because he gets hurt a lot and they've decided Brett Phillips can't hit because he hasn't shown that he can hit yet. You want somebody who can slide in there. And I don't know if that's Cameron Maybin, who's had a really good season for the Yankees. I don't know if that's maybe trying to mend some fences with Gerard Dyson just as a stopgap. I don't know who that might be, but that wouldn't be the worst idea in my mind in free agency. But you know, for 2020, you really got to see what you have in Bubba Starling and Brett Phillips, I think. Because if either one of those is going to be a key piece of a 2021 and beyond team, you got to know. You got to figure that out. And you're not going to figure that out if they're playing once a week. So, yeah, you might take some losses, but really, does it change much? No. So I think they need to learn about these guys. I'm not convinced they will. Dayton Moore does not like to do that. He likes to go get proven guys, which, you know, for better or for worse, I don't know. But if it's me, I just run with those guys and see where you are by midseason at the very least.
How good do you think Salvador Perez can be next season, and how much of an impact do you think he can have on the team?
Yeah, I wonder that because, I mean, behind the plate, yeah, he'll be fine. He's got a year of no knee stress, which is nice. He hasn't had a year off his knees in forever, probably. So that's good. You wonder what his arm will be. You know, you just don't know how he'll throw. Offensively, I don't think there's any worries, especially if they keep the super heavy fun ball, because he's a guy who can really benefit from a juiced baseball. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we'll see what his arm looks like. That to me is the biggest concern. I want to see how he throws, because, you know, that's his best attribute. So hopefully he's fully recovered and ready to go by April, or I guess late March this year.
We're talking with David Leske of Baseball Prospectus here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk. So before I let you go, I do want to talk a little MLB postseason with you. Right now, down to the championship series, Nationals up 2-0 on the Cardinals. Game 3 of that is tonight. Right now, is it kind of looking like the Nationals are the team of destiny?
Yeah, I mean, Cardinals have 4 hits in the series, right? That's not really a way to win baseball games. And they got Steven Strasburg to face tonight in Washington. It's not going to get easier. If they can't win this game, I would not be surprised if the series is over tomorrow. I think that once you go down 3-0 on the road, that's tough. We saw it in the 2014 ALCS when the Royals took the first 2 games from the Orioles. You know, they knew they weren't going back to Baltimore. And I think the Nationals know they're not going back to St. Louis. I just think they know. With that pitching staff and how bad the Cardinals' offense has been, I don't know how the Cardinals can win 2 games. They might be able to pull one out, but I don't know how they can win 2 of 3 and take it back to St. Louis. So I think the series is over. And I wrote the preview for Baseball Prospectus. I think the Cardinals may win tonight because Jack Flaherty is that good. But boy, they're in a world of hurt right now.
Can you believe that Jack Flaherty, Lucas Giolito, and Max Fried were all on the same high school team?
Did they win state? They had to have won like every state championship, right?
I think they did. I'm actually from Southern California, and some of my friends who played baseball were actually on a team who lost them in like the second round of the playoffs, and they said it was just unbelievable. I would imagine they did.
That's just stupid. It's not fair. That should have never been allowed. They should have made one of their families move at least.
Yeah, but hey, now all having tons of success right now. As far as the ALCS goes, Astros Yankees tied 1-1 after the walk-off home run last night. I was wondering this after game one, though, because he struggled in his first game against the Rays, and he had never really been a great postseason pitcher, even when he was with the Dodgers. He wasn't awful, but it seemed like he would always blow a late lead. Do you think the Astros should be regretting the Greinke trade at all in terms of maybe using similar assets to acquire maybe a different position?
No, I don't think they should regret it. I think that the big issue, and I've talked about this a little bit, Greinke's velocity gives him less margin for error. He's not throwing 97 anymore. He's 89, 90, 91. You know, he's not pumping it up there too hard. And, you know, when you have that issue, when you don't have the velocity, you can't make mistakes, and he's been making a couple mistakes in this postseason so far. All in all, though, they still have 3 more years of him, 2 or 3 more years of him, and they need the rotation help moving forward because they're going to lose Garrett Cole. So it may not end up being the move that wins them the World Series, although they still might, in spite of what he's done in his first 2 playoff starts. But he's going to help him get back there throughout the rest of his contract at the very least. I don't think they're regretting it, but at the same time, I do wonder what they could have done if they had put a package together for Zach Wheeler, or I'm not necessarily going to trade him, but if they could have found a way to get a guy who stuff might play better in October than Greinke's. All that said, if he went out and he threw 7 innings in 1-run baseball his next time out, I don't think it would surprise anybody. So I don't think they're regretting it, but he definitely hasn't helped his cause in his first 2 playoff starts, that's for sure.
So given where we are right now, 1-1 in the ALCS, 2-0 in the NLCS favoring the Nats, what's kind of your prediction for the rest of the way?
I think the Nats take it, like I said, maybe by tomorrow. If not, I think they win it on Wednesday at home. I think the Astros still pull it out because I think they're the better team. I think the Yankees, the way Aaron Boone has handled his bullpen, which he's done a fine job with it, but they're going to wear out. And at some point, one of those guys is going to have a bad outing and give the Astros a win they probably don't deserve. And I think ultimately that'll end up giving them the series. And so I think it's going to be an Astros-Nationals World Series. And I still think the Astros are the best team. I think, you know, I mentioned this Cardinals-Astros or Cardinals-Nationals. Nationals have the best players. They're the best players in that series. And in a 7-game series, the best players win. Nationals, Astros, the Astros have the best players. So that's why I go with them. And they're going to win their second title in 3 years.
All right. You heard it from David Leske himself of Baseball Prospectus. Thanks for the time, David.
Yep. Thank you.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Fifteen till the top of the hour here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk. I'm Derek Johnson filling in for Nick Schwert on the day on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. It's that time of the day. It's that time of the week. Time for my college football playoff rankings. So last week, well, let's just start with this. Who's off the list from last week? Number 6, Ohio State. They had a bye week. You don't play anyone. Goodbye. Number 8, Iowa State in October. They'll stick around. They had another good week, but a team behind them just excelled even more, and they got hopped, which leads to number 8 on this week's list of my college football playoff rankings. South Carolina, when Will Muschamp has glasses. A new entrant into the list, the Gamecocks were off to a 1-3 start this season. But head coach Will Muschamp then decided he needed to see that vision was kind of important. So he decided to start wearing glasses. The result? Well, maybe he can actually read plays now and see things. And it's had a positive effect on South Carolina, as you can imagine. They're now 2-0 since he started wearing glasses with wins over Kentucky 24-7. And now, this past Saturday, 20-17 in double overtime on the road against Georgia. In fact, Georgia quarterback Jake Fromm was 20-0 against unranked teams and 16-0 at home before South Carolina and Will Muschamp with glasses pulled off the double overtime upset. Big one upcoming this week for South Carolina with Will Muschamp in glasses. They take on Florida, but for now, South Carolina, when Will Muschamp has glasses, comes in at number 8. Number 7, reappearing on the list and in at number 7, the LSU Tigers. So LSU was on this list a few weeks earlier, but they dropped off because they had a bye week. Now they hop back on with a 42-28 victory over the Florida Gators. The Tigers continue to do it with their offense led by Joe Burrow, who might just be the best quarterback in the entire country. In fact, I think he is. LSU averaged 10.6 yards per play. That's over a first down per play against Florida, a really good defense. And that was actually LSU's most ever yards per play against a ranked or SEC opponent. And they only got to third down four times all night. So they were pretty much just dominating that really good Florida defense. LSU might have the best offense in the entire country, which is really weird. So LSU, who has big wins over Texas and now Florida, comes in at number 7. Moving up a spot to number 6, Oregon for 359 minutes and 51 seconds. The Ducks dominated another opponent, taking out Colorado on Friday night 45-3. They had over 500 yards of offense. It was a balanced offense. They passed the ball. They ran the ball over the field. And they held the Buffaloes to under 300 yards with 4 turnovers. And as much as the offense that averages 36 a contest gets hype when you have a quarterback like Justin Herbert and a really good running back like CJ Verdell, well, it's been the defense that is really, I wouldn't say carrying this team because they're just dominating overall, but the defense is kind of the highlight right now. Oregon has not allowed a touchdown in 57 of their last 58 defensive possessions. They're allowing just 8.7 points per game. And on top of it all, they're averaging 2 interceptions per game. So the Ducks, for 359 minutes and 51 seconds, remain unbeaten and move up from number 7 to number 6. Once again, in at number 5. Anyone not named UMass playing Rutgers. Things continue to be a struggle for Rutgers, which therefore means anyone not named UMass playing Rutgers, is exceeding expectations. This past weekend, over 90% of the bets in Vegas were on Indiana minus 28 against the Scarlet Knights. Again, people were that confident in Indiana because they were playing Rutgers. And guess what? That confidence was well-founded. Indiana dominated Rutgers 35-0, and that was coasting. Just 6 minutes into the game, Indiana was beating Rutgers 21-0. 6 minutes into it. A minute 30 into it, it was 14-0. This is maybe the most dumbfounding thing ever. Rutgers quarterback Johnny Langan went 5 of 13 for 1 yard. He threw 13 passes and had one passing yard. He had 5 completions and had 1 passing yard. Rutgers has now been shut out more times than any other Big Ten team since 2000. And the Scarlet Knights didn't even join the Big Ten until 2014. I don't really need to explain anymore, so I won't. Anyone not named UMass playing Rutgers in at number 5. All right, also sitting in at number 4 once again. Anyone not named Akron playing UMass? UMass had the task of going up against Louisiana Tech on Saturday and fell to the Bulldogs 69-21. The Minutemen wound up allowing 689 total yards of offense, over 300 passing, nearly 400 on the ground. That dropped UMass to 1-6, meaning anyone not named Akron playing UMass is 6-0. In fact, of those 6 teams to beat UMass, they're averaging 53 points per game. It's just excellent offense from anyone not named Akron playing UMass, which is a big reason why they come in at number 4. Into the top 3, at number 3, staying at number 3, anyone playing Akron. Another week, another loss for the Zips. They're now 0-6 on the season. That means anyone playing Akron is now 6-0. The latest team to join this group was Kent State, who's not anything special. I mean, it's Kent State. But Kent State still manhandled Akron 26-3, and the Zips were held to 288 total yards of offense. Through 6 weeks, Akron's leading rusher is their quarterback, Cato Nelson. And their leading rusher, Cato Nelson, only has 131 rushing yards through 6 weeks. That's less than 30 a game. They're averaging 14 points per game and giving up 36. So anyone playing Akron continues to show off and earns another impressive victory to stay in at number 3. All right, now I'm getting real excited. Into the top 2. Remaining in at number 2, the Wisconsin Badgers. The Badgers' defense has been incredible this season. Through 6 games, they have 4 shutouts. So 2/3 of the time, they're getting a shutout following another one in which they downed Michigan State 38-0. They held the Spartans to just 149 total yards of offense. 149, that's it. On their end, Wisconsin had 222 rushing yards. So more than 70 rushing yards than Michigan State had total yards. And in doing so, Wisconsin became the first team since 1967 Oklahoma, one of my favorites, to have their 4th shutout through just 6 games. Overall for the season, Wisconsin's 8th in the country in scoring offense. They're over 42 points per game, while they have the top defense in holding the opposition to under 5 points per game. It's at 4.8 currently. They'll be at Illinois this week, and then they got the big one 2 weeks from now. They're going to go on the road to battle Ohio State. For now, though, they've shown more than enough for a top 2 spot. That's why Wisconsin in at number 2. All right, our top team in at number 1 again for another new record of time in at number 1 in my college football playoff rankings. You guessed it. Jalen Hurts' humbleness and humility. The Sooners earned a big win in the Red River rivalry, downing Texas 34-27. It was probably actually the worst performance of the season for Jalen Hurts in terms of production. But he still wound up with over 350 yards and 4 touchdowns as his Sooners are now 6-0. They're in the driver's seat to win the Big 12. They're in the driver's seat to make a college football playoff appearance. But once again, what did impress without any fumbles or interceptions or mistakes this week wasn't as much Jalen Hurts' performance. It was Jalen Hurts' humbleness and humility. And this week started out one of his best performances.
Now, I'll say that I definitely didn't put the team in the greatest and best situations, but the key about that is we found ways to overcome it. We had each other's back. Obviously, every position you wanted to end in a kick. So it's a lot to learn from the game and all. That I definitely think that this team shows some perseverance and shows some mental toughness and kind of overcame a lot of adversity as a group. And not a complete game, but definitely another step in the right direction.
My favorite part is he's like, we. Thank you, Jalen. But that's just another piece of his humbleness and humility. And that was the start to a great performance for his humbleness and humility. But it took a little bit of a nosedive. He did have one mistake. On Sunday, he quote tweeted a SportsCenter highlight of one of his plays. That's not the level of humbleness we're used to. But the initial performance was good enough to balance it out and hang on to Jalen Hurts' humbleness and humility in at number one. I will say, though, back-to-back weeks with the chink in the armor could be troubling. But once again, just hanging on by a thread this time to the number one spot. Our longest tenured number one team takes care of that top spot in Jalen Hurts' humbleness and humility. That's my college football playoff rankings. You're listening to Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.